听力课堂，听 class.com。
全国翻译专业资格水平考试指定教材，英语口译综合能力三级，第五核。
Sample Test 1 Part 1 A.Let's face it, we all have some form of stress, whether it's due to work, school reports, family, or relationships. We could all use a break now and then. Yet in the hustle and bustle of everyday life, a lot of us can't find the time to just drop everything and take it easy. Well, what if someone told you that by just playing music from classical composers like Mozart or Strauss, you might find your job a little easier?And that you might even be able to relax. This has actually been found to be true. Listening to classical music has proven to be beneficial to learning and mind relaxation. It can also reduce our levels of stress. Various studies of children have shown that those who receive music education or play a musical instrument often have increased academic skills. Don Campbell, author of The Mozart Effect,has dedicated himself to studying the effects of music on the mind and body. He counsels students that classical music playing in the background can help them concentrate for longer periods of time and memorize material more easily. He feels that Mozart's music has a balance that makes it especially beneficial. But Campbell doesn't stop with Mozart. He says that Bach can stimulate the mind, military marches can rev up the body,and religious music can help create a meditative mood. It's important to find what works best for your situation. So the next time you feel yourself overwhelmed with work and deadlines, or if you're just finding it difficult to concentrate, remember the power of music.
B. 1. Nancy has completely stayed off cigarettes after her last visit to the physician.
2. My boss had me finish all the month-end reports, so I was very late in getting home from work.
3. If you want me to recommend a hotel in New York, you need to tell me your budget first.
4. He didn't get high scores in the entrance examination, so he wasn't admitted to the university.
5. To supplement his scholarship, he has a part-time job in a law firm downtown.
6. He's got a dental appointment for tomorrow afternoon, so I'm afraid he can't come to this meeting.
7. We should take some of the furniture out of here, or maybe we should look for a bigger apartment.
8. I'd like to inquire about the charges on my electricity bills. It is so high this month.
9. The medicine the doctor gave me seemed to have helped, but it's making me awfully drowsy.
10. According to the regulations, visitors aren't allowed to stay in the hospital after 10 o'clock.
Part 2. Today I'd like to talk about how to become a foreign correspondent. Usually, you have to start at the beginning. That is, you have to begin as a journalist of some sort on a local newspaper, a local radio station, maybe on a small magazine. Work your way up. Now, there aren't that many organizations which have large numbers of foreign correspondents, so you also have to sort of work with that aim in mind.Another way of doing it is to work abroad and work as a freelance. That's somebody who sells stories and gets paid by the piece to newspapers and magazines and so on, and hoping to build up a reputation that way and eventually to be offered a full-time job. I don't really know what qualifications are needed, but obviously a degree in modern languages or political science or economics would be very useful. But a degree in itself probably wouldn't be the key. It wouldn't be enough to get you the job. It wouldn't be enough to make an editor decide to send you abroad. So it's difficult to define the precise qualities. You're going to need stamina and the ability to assimilate information quickly and accurately, and then produce stories which fit the style of the newspaper or radio or television station you work for.
Part 3. Passage 1. There are many theories about the beginning of drama in ancient Greece. The one most widely accepted today is based on the assumption that drama evolved from ritual. The argument for this view goes as follows. In the beginning, human beings viewed the natural forces of the world, even the seasonal changes, as unpredictable, and they sought through various means to control these unknown and feared powers. Those measures which appeared to bring the desired results were then retained and repeated until they hardened into fixed rituals. Eventually, stories arose which explained or veiled the mysteries of the rites. As time passed, some rituals were abandoned, but the stories, later called myths, persisted and provided material for art and drama. Those who believe that drama evolved out of ritual also argue that those rites contained a seed of theater because music, dance, masks, and costumes were almost always used. Furthermore, a suitable site had to be provided for performances, and when the entire community did not participate, a clear division was usually made between the acting area and the auditorium. In addition, there were performers, and since considerable importance was attached to avoiding mistakes in the enactment of rites, religious leaders usually assumed that task. Wearing masks and costumes, they often impersonated other people, animals, or supernatural beings, and mimed the desired effect. Success in hunt or battle, the coming rain, the revival of the sun, as an actor might. Eventually, such dramatic representations were separated from religious activities. Another theory traces the theater's origin from the human interest in storytelling. According to this theory, ancient stories about the hunt, war, or other feats are gradually elaborated, at first through the use of impersonation, action, and dialogue by a narrator, and then through the assumption of each of the roles by a different person. A closely related theory traces theater to those dances that are primarily rhythmical and gymnastic, or that are imitations of animal movements and sounds.
Passage 2. Andrew Carnegie, known as the King of Steel, built the steel industry in the United States, and in the process, became one of the wealthiest men in America. His success resulted in part from his ability to sell the product, and in part from his policy of expanding during periods of economic decline when most of his competitors were reducing their investments. Carnegie believed that individuals should progress through hard work, but he also felt strongly that the wealthy should use their fortunes for the benefit of society. He opposed charity, preferring instead to provide educational opportunities that would allow others to help themselves. "He who dies rich dies disgraced," he often said. Among his more noteworthy contributions to society are those that bear his name, including the Carnegie Institute of Pittsburgh, which has a library, a museum of fine arts, and a museum of national history. He also founded a school of technology that is now part of Carnegie Mellon University. Other philanthropic gifts are the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace to promote understanding between nations, the Carnegie Institute of Washington to fund scientific research, and Carnegie Hall to provide a center for the arts. Few Americans have been left untouched by Andrew Carnegie's generosity. His contributions of more than $5 million established 2,500 libraries in small communities throughout the country, and that we all enjoy today.
Passage 3. The American Revolution was not a sudden and violent overturning of the political and social framework, such as later occurred in France and Russia, when both were already independent nations. Significant changes were ushered in, but they were not breathtaking. What happened was accelerated evolution rather than outright revolution. During the conflict itself, people went on working and praying, marrying, and playing. Most of them are not seriously disturbed by the actual fighting, and many of the more isolated communities scarcely knew that a war was on. America's War of Independence heralded the birth of three modern nations. One was Canada, which received its first large influx of English-speaking population from the thousands of loyalists who fled there from the United States. Another was Australia, which became a penal colony now that America was no longer available for prisoners and debtors. The third newcomer, the United States, based itself squarely on Republican principles. Yet even the political overturn was not so revolutionary as one might suppose. In some states, notably Connecticut and Rhode Island, the war largely ratified a colonial self-rule already existing. British officials, everywhere ousted, were replaced by a homegrown governing class, which promptly sought a local substitute for king and parliament.
Part 4. Today I'd like to talk about love between child and parent. For most children before the age from 8.5 to 10, the problem is almost exclusively that of being loved, of being loved for what one is. The child up to this age does not yet love. He responds gratefully and joyfully to being loved. At this point of the child's development, a new factor enters into the picture, that of producing love by one's own activity. For the first time, the child thinks of giving something to mother or to father. For the first time in the child's life, the idea of love is changed from being loved into loving, into creating love. It takes many years from this first beginning to the maturing of love. Eventually, the child may now be an adolescent and has overcome his egocentricity. The other person is not anymore primarily a means to the satisfaction of his own needs. The needs of the other person are as important as his own. In fact, they have become more important. To give has become more satisfactory and more joyous than to receive. To love has become more important even than being loved. Closely related to development of the capacity of love is the development of the object of love. The first months and years of the child are those where his closest attachment is to the mother. This attachment begins before the moment of birth, when mother and child are still one, although they are two. Although the child is now living outside of the womb, he is still completely dependent on mother. But he becomes more independent day by day. He learns to walk, to talk, and to explore the world on his own. The relationship to mother loses some of its vital significance, and instead the relationship to father becomes more and more important. In order to understand this shift from mother to father, we must consider the essential differences in quality between motherly and fatherly love. We have already spoken about motherly love. Motherly love, by its very nature, is unconditional. Mother loves the newborn infant because it is her child, not because the child has fulfilled any specific condition or lived up to any specific expectation. The relationship to father is quite different. Mother is the home we come from. She is nature, soil, the ocean. Father does not represent any such natural home. He has little connection with the child in the first years of its life, and his importance for the child in this period cannot be compared with that of mother. But while father does not represent the natural world, he represents the other pole of human existence. He represents the world of thought, of law and order, of discipline, and of travel and adventure. Father is the one who teaches the child, who shows him the road into the world. Closely related to this function is one which is connected with socio-economic development. When private property came into existence, and when private property could be inherited by one of the sons, father began to look for that son to whom he could leave his property. Naturally, that was the one whom father thought best fitted to become his successor, the son who was most like him and consequently whom he likes the most. Fatherly love is conditional love. Its principle is, I love you because you fulfill my expectations, because you do your duty, because you are like me. In conditional fatherly love, we find a negative and a positive aspect. The negative aspect is the very fact that fatherly love has to be deserved, that it can be lost if one does not do what is expected. In the nature of fatherly love lies the fact that obedience becomes the main virtue, that disobedience is the main sin, and its punishment is the withdrawal of fatherly love.
Sample Test 2. Part 1. A. There are many occasions on which you can be expected to talk about your firm. This may include actually showing someone physically around the place of work or premises, but it may more generally involve referring to the way in which the company is organized and run. Firms are a very important part of the economy. They are responsible for producing goods and services. Businesses come in every shape and size. While the vast majority of the world's businesses are small, large firms often dominate the economy in some countries. Indeed, the income of the world's largest 50 industrial companies added together represents more than half the total output of the United States. Large businesses differ very much from small ones in a wide variety of ways. In many countries, there are both private firms and nationalized firms belonging to the government. A small private firm may have just one owner, but a very large firm has thousands of shareholders. In very large firms, the owners have very little to do with the day-to-day running of the firm. This is left to the management. Very large companies may be organized into several large departments, or sometimes even divisions. The organizational structure of some companies is very hierarchical, with the board of directors at the top and the various departmental heads reporting to them. Often the only time shareholders can influence the board is at yearly shareholders' meetings. Some firms may only produce one product or service. Others may produce many different products. In fact, they may seem to be like a collection of businesses inside one company. The bigger a business becomes, the further it may expand geographically. Many large firms have manufacturing plants and trading locations in several different countries spread around the world.
B. 1. There is a wonderful movie tonight. Wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have to work at night?
2. The bicycle rider was refused help by several passing motorists on the side of a highway.
3. The lawyer revealed that John was named the only beneficiary in his uncle's will.
4. The retired engineer was unhappy because the lawyer turned down his case.
5. After the building was damaged by a fire, the inhabitants were paid by the insurance company.
6. As the technology of electronics improves, the prices of personal computers should come down.
7. Mona has been offered the manager's job, although she has hardly any work experience.
8. She voted against the investment plan because she thinks it involves too great a risk.
9. The landlord collects rent on the first of the month without fail.
10. We'd like to have a table by the window, but that table has been reserved.
Part 2. I'd like to talk about local government in England and Wales. And in England and Wales, there are two main types of council. For instance, if I could take the example of Oxfordshire, there is one county council where they are responsible for education, social services, structure planning, highways, libraries, and museums, and so on. And there are 5 district councils, again in Oxfordshire, and they are responsible for housing, in particular council housing, for local plans, for dustbin collection, environmental health, and they're also responsible for swimming baths, and in Oxford, for instance, they are building an ice rink in the middle of the city. If we could talk particularly about the question of education, I think this would illustrate the idea of local government in the best way possible. First of all, there is a minister at central government level. He is the Minister for Education, and he is responsible for running a comprehensive education system in the whole country. But in practice, there is a lot of local control. So the local councils, county councils, such as Oxfordshire County Council, actually run the schools and colleges in their areas.
Part 3. Passage 1. For the last 82 years, Sweden's Nobel Academy has decided who will receive the Nobel Prize in Literature, thereby determining who will be elevated from the great and the near great to the immortal. but today the Academy is coming under heavy criticism, both from the without and from within. Critics contend that the selection of the winners often has less to do with true writing ability than with the peculiar internal politics of the Academy and of Sweden itself. According to Ingmar Bjorksten, the cultural editor for one of the country's two major newspapers, the prize continues to represent what people call a very Swedish exercise, reflecting Swedish tastes. The Academy has defended itself against such charges of provincialism in its selection by asserting that its physical distance from the great literary capitals of the world actually serves to protect the Academy from outside influences. This may well be true, but critics respond that this very distance may also be responsible for the Academy's inability to perceive accurately authentic trends in the literary world. Regardless of concerns over the selection process, however, it seems that the prize will continue to survive, both as an indicator of the literature that we most highly praise and as an elusive goal that writers seek. If for no other reason, the prize will continue to be desirable for the financial rewards that accompany it. Not only is the cash prize itself considerable, but it also dramatically increases sales of an author's books.
Passage 2. In the late 18th century, battles raged in almost every corner of Europe, as well as in the Middle East, South Africa, the West Indies, and Latin America. In reality, however, there was only one major war during this time, the war between Britain and France. All other battles were ancillary to this larger conflict, and were often at least partially related to its antagonists' goals and strategies. France sought total domination of Europe. This goal was obstructed by British independence and Britain's efforts throughout the continent to thwart Napoleon through treaties. Britain built coalitions, not dissimilar in concept to today's NATO, guaranteeing British participation in all major European conflicts. These two antagonists were poorly matched, insofar as they had very unequal strengths. France was predominant on land, Britain at sea. The French knew that, short of defeating the British navy, their only hope of victory was to close all the ports of Europe to British ships. Accordingly, France set out to overcome Britain by extending its military domination from Moscow to Lisbon, from Jutland to Calgary. All of this entailed tremendous risk, because France did not have the military resources to control this much territory and still protect itself and maintain order at home. French strategists calculated that a navy of 150 ships would provide the force necessary to defeat the British navy. Such a force would give France a 3-2 advantage over Britain. This advantage was deemed necessary because of Britain's superior sea skills and technology, and also because Britain would be fighting a defensive war, allowing it to win with fewer forces. Napoleon never lost substantial impediment to his control of Europe. As his force neared that goal, Napoleon grew increasingly impatient and began planning an immediate attack.
Passage 3. The pound plunged to its lowest level against the dollar for 4 years as the American currency soared to a new peak on the world's financial markets. Share prices received a shock yesterday when the government increased interest rates to 15%. As a result, the FTSE slumped 42 points, closing at 2,281, its lowest level for 10 weeks. Minsk Data announced reductions in its workforce yesterday. Because of a small dip in profits, the company is in the red for the first time. Yesterday, in a major collapse on the Tokyo stock market, the Nikkei average plunged 559 points. Because of the failure of the powerful New York bond market. And because of a sudden surge in profits from its overseas operations, Drexel is back in the black after 2 years of disappointing results. Well, there's nothing like an attack of nerves on Wall Street for unsettling the world's stock markets. Already an overnight plunge of 53.71 in the Dow Jones has had an impact in the Far East. As a result, the UK market is likely to be depressed later this morning. The Dow fell almost 2% to 2,882, ending a rally that's been going on for several weeks. Back home, having fallen 21 points yesterday, the London share market badly needs good news to improve the situation. However, rumours that Britain's trade figures for the next quarter are disappointing again will not help.
Part 4. I have been the director of Friends of the Earth for 3 years. It's a campaigning pressure group dealing with a whole series of environmental issues. Some of those are international issues, such as the protection of the rainforests or acid rain. Some are to do with natural concerns, such as planning policy or protection of the countryside. A lot of the things that we're involved in are to do with people's ordinary backyard environment, as it were. Small-scale things, like what the individual can do on recycling or just improving the quality of their own environment. So it covers a wide range of different issues, from the very small personal concerns right through to the biggest international issues. These issues are all very important, but I think it has to be said that as far as we're concerned, as a campaigning organization, it really is the rainforest that we are concentrating on most. If we don't take action on that issue within the next 5 years, then environmental pressure groups won't have anything to do in 10 years' time, because there won't be any rainforest, really, for them to campaign about. So this is a critical period for the rainforests, the next 5 years, and there is enough flexibility in the system to allow us to hope that we're going to be able to make some changes during that time. So that's why we've made it our priority. You may ask, what's the difference between having them and not having them? Isn't it just basically either there's a lot of trees there or there aren't a lot of trees there? Well, that's what some people would like to think. I think President Reagan was famous for saying, seen one tree, seen them all. And basically, this is not the attitude that we have. It's important in many different ways. Important, firstly, for the countries themselves, in terms of the fact that millions of people depend on the rainforest for their livelihood, and for the quality of their environment through the protection of watersheds and so on. Secondly, they're important because of the biological richness of the rainforests. A genetic treasure chest is how they have been described. More than 60% of the world's species is to be found in the rainforests. Write that off, and you write off the genetic storehouse. Lastly, they're important at an international level because of the impact on climatic patterns that one would find if the rainforests were destroyed. So, whether you're looking closely at the tribal people who depend on them, the countries which depend on them, the international community which depends on them, indeed, you know, it's actually the most critical issue that we face. And our prime job is, of course, to try and get people to understand how it is, even in countries where there is no rainforests, that they still have a connection with the rainforests.